Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the inaugural Fetty Night Fight, brought to you by the Federalist Society Student Division and the Federalist Society at UVA Law. My name is Rachel Daly, and I'm the president of the Federalist Society Student Chapter at UVA Law. I'm honored to be here tonight to say a little bit about Fetty Night Fights and introduce our two distinguished fighters. Fetty Night Fights is a new series put on by the Federalist Society Student Division. Each month, the Student Division and one law school chapter will co-host a virtual showcase debate that will stream to Federalist Society chapters nationwide. The UVA Law chapter is delighted to be hosting the first debate in this series. Now to our fighters. First, in the anti-federalist corner is a man Alexander Hamilton is glad he never met, Judge Andrew S. Oldham. Judge Oldham is a circuit judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Before ascending to the bench, Judge Oldham served as general counsel to Texas Governor Greg Abbott and as deputy solicitor general for the state of Texas. Before moving to Texas, Judge Oldham was an attorney at Kellogg Hanson Todd Feigl & Frederick in Washington, D.C. His practice focused on appellate litigation in federal courts of appeals throughout the country. Before entering private practice, Judge Oldham served as a law clerk to Justice Alito and to Judge Sentell at the D.C. Circuit. He also worked as an attorney advisor in the Office of Legal Counsel at the U.S. Department of Justice from 2006 to 2008. Judge Oldham earned a BA here at the University of Virginia with highest honors, a Truman Scholarship for graduate school, an MPhil first class with distinction from Cambridge University, and a JD magna cum laude from Harvard Law School. Judge Oldham also co-teaches a January term course here at UVA Law called Founders and Foes, which focuses on the Federalist anti-Federalist debates. In the Federalist corner, we have Dr. John S. Baker Jr. In the ring, they call him Publius. Dr. Baker is a visiting professor at the Georgetown Center for the Constitution, professor emeritus at LSU Law School, and visiting professor at Peking University School of Transnational Law, where he is currently teaching a course in U.S. constitutional law via Zoom. He has been a visiting fellow at Oriel College at the University of Oxford, and he also has taught and lectured in many foreign countries. Before teaching, he clerked in federal court and served as a state prosecutor. Since becoming a professor, he has been a consultant to committees in both houses of Congress, several federal departments and agencies, and during the Reagan administration, to the Office of Planning in the White House. He has had two oral arguments in the U.S. Supreme Court, and over a period of 25 years, he co-taught the Federalist Society seminar on separation of powers with the late Justice Scalia. Dr. Baker received his JD with honors from the University of Michigan Law School and his BA magna cum laude from the University of Dallas. He also earned a PhD in political thought from the University of London. At the end of this evening's debate, we will open up the floor for questions from the audience. You must be logged in as a participant in the Zoom webinar in order to ask a question. Please use the raise hand function in Zoom to enter the queue. And when we get to your question, I will call on you by name and the Zoom host will unmute your microphone so you can ask your question. If you're calling in from a phone, you can press *9 on your phone to raise your hand. Before we officially get started, our fighters are going to briefly greet one another. So let's go to Judge Oldham first.
Thank you so much, Rachel. I am so grateful to be here. It is such a privilege and an honor. I'm grateful to the Federalist Society for hosting the event and Peter Redpath for putting on the Fetty Night Fight. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really grateful to the University of Virginia, as you mentioned, my alma mater, and to you, Rachel, and the Federalist Society there for putting this on. I think it's particularly wonderful to talk about the Anti-Federalists at an event sponsored by the University of Virginia, because we wouldn't know anything about the Anti-Federalists, in my view, were it not for Herbert Storing, who was the Robert Kent Gooch Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs at the University of Virginia many years ago. And last but not least, I'm certainly grateful to my dear friend, Professor John Baker. He is a gentleman and a scholar, and he has forgotten more about tonight's topic than I will ever know. So it is a great privilege to share a stage with you. Your eminence obviously makes me the underdog in tonight's fight, but that's okay, because the Anti-Federalists were underdogs too. So thank you both.
I've heard that business about being the underdog, and I don't believe it, so, but it is an honor. And they should know, the audience should know, we've done this a couple of times before, and they're in for a real treat. I mean, I knew you were good, but when I heard you at the Reagan Library, I was really impressed and knew what a scholar you were of the Anti-Federalists. And so I had to learn a lot, and our audience is going to be well-educated tonight. I also obviously want to thank the University of Virginia Law School chapter of the Federalist Society, in particular Rachel, and the Federalist Society, not only the the people you see, but also the people you don't see, the tech guys, Matt and Aaron, are very important to this thing. We wouldn't be here, because I can tell you, I've learned to screw up Zoom many a time, and they've helped me out of it. So, but I want to especially thank Peter Redpath, because Peter, I got to say, Peter, this is very innovative. You're very creative. Although I know you couldn't have done it without Kate Alcantara. So just kudos to all of you at the main office, and also to Rachel and the chapter there.
Thank you, fighters. We're now ready to turn to the main event. Coming to you live from various locations via Zoom, the Federalist Society is proud to present Fetty Night Fight.
Wonderful. All right, so let's get started with something that I think we all know, and that is who the Federalists were, right? They were obviously the protagonists. They were the ones that we study. They're the ones who were in Clinton Rossiter's Federalist Papers that we carry around, and especially at Federalist Society events we often talk about. And they were all very famous men. They really don't need any introduction, but for the sake of completeness, why don't we identify them? James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. Madison was obviously the leader of the first Congress, in which he, among other things, introduced the Bill of Rights. His silhouette is obviously the one that appears at every Federalist Society event. Jay was the first Chief Justice of the United States. Hamilton was obviously the first Secretary of the Treasury before he became, perhaps as importantly, a Broadway star. And the three of them wrote 85 separate papers, which today we call the Federalist, all of which were published in New York, and they signed all of them under the pseudonym Publius. The pseudonym Publius, of course, honors this man, Publius Valerius Publicola. This is a portrait of him from Mary Evans. And he is one of the four men who led the Roman Revolution, was elected to the second consulate of Rome. And in this picture, I hope you can see on your computer screens that Mary Evans drew, Publius, when he was elected to the second consulate, he had been building his house on the top of a hill overlooking the Roman Senate. And he was accused of building his house on the top of the hill because he wanted to be king, to which he responded, "I have just liberated Rome bravely, but now I am slandered. I am the bitterest enemy of the former kings, so I shouldn't be accused of wanting to be king." At which point he dramatically threw the stones of his home from the top of the hill down to the bottom, which is what is depicted in the picture. So obviously someone who would be a venerated name in the principles of the Roman Republic. And so all three of the men on the left signed their papers, Publius, in honor of the one on the right. And all three of the men on the left are obviously quite famous. We know a ton about them. And as it is often said, history is written by the victors. The people we know less about are the anti-federalists, the ones that I would like to talk about principally tonight. One thing that we do know about them is that they, like their Federalist counterparts, revered the Roman Republic, and with it, the principles of little r republican government. And that's why they named themselves things like Brutus, after Lucius Junius Brutus. He was the one who overthrew his uncle, the last king of Rome, and instituted the Roman Republic in 509 BC. And he was elected to the first Roman consulate. Or Cato, Cato the Younger, who famously committed suicide rather than live under the rule of Caesar, the same Cato who was lionized in Addison's play in the early 18th century, Cato, a tragedy that George Washington displayed to the soldiers at Valley Forge, and Cincinnatus, who was the third consul of Rome in 460 BC for a brief time after Publius was killed. Cincinnatus retired to the countryside, and then in 458 BC, he unretired from the countryside, leaving behind his plow. That's what's depicted in this statue here with his right foot on the plow, when his republic needed him to return to leadership and fend off a battle at the dramatic invasion of the Battle of Mount Algidus. And so for much of American history, one of my concerns about the Anti-Federalists is that this is basically how we remember them. They are faceless pseudonyms in the spirit of a Roman Republic, but not much else was known about them. And even today, when we study them, we have a lot of question marks. And you might think that that's a good thing. After all, they lost their boxing match, right, with the Federalists. Well, yes, I suppose in a sense, and we'll talk about that a little bit tonight. But they won in other ways. You know, one of the most important parts of the Constitution is the Bill of Rights. And it could be argued that we wouldn't have a Bill of Rights, but for the arguments raised by the Anti-Federalists. And even as to the seven articles in the Constitution itself, the Anti-Federalists, these three and others with similar pseudonyms, the Anti-Federalists were the ones who struck the first blow. They were the ones who threw the first punch. It's a very common misconception, I think, that the Federalists were the ones who laid out this comprehensive argument in favor of the Constitution. After all, when we read the Federalist Papers, and we have so many, you know, printed and dog-eared copies of this book, rightly so, it reads like a coherent argument in favor of the Constitution. And so one misconception, and I often, when I talk to people at lawyers chapters and student chapters across the country, is that the Federalists sort of laid this out and that the Anti-Federalists were anti the Federalist argument. That is, they came second and sort of threw pot shots or shot pot shots at the Federalist argument. And that's wrong and in two, I think, really important ways. First, as we are tonight, the Anti-Federalists were the ones who went first. They were the ones who published the first essays. They were the ones who mounted the first offensive. They were the ones who threw the first punch. In many ways, the Federalists were the ones who were playing defense. But the second way that the common misconception, I think, is quite wrong, and I hope that our conversation tonight will illustrate, is that the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists agreed on a lot, even if they disagreed about very important ways that they wanted to pursue their shared goals. So for every one of you who carries and quotes Clinton Rossiter, as I do, I think you need to pause and understand the people, namely the Anti-Federalists, to whom the Federalists were responding, and also the broad agreements between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, which I think are almost as important, if not more important, than their disagreements. So let's go a little bit deeper and talk about these three and a couple of other Anti-Federalists to sort of get tonight going and get the discussion going about what the Anti-Federalists thought and why they were worried about the Constitution. So let's start with Brutus. Our best guess is that Brutus's letters were written by this man, Robert Yates. Robert Yates was a surveyor and a lawyer in Albany, New York. He entered local politics in the 1770s, and he joined what was then the Young American Revolutionary Movement. In 1776, he helped draft the first state constitution, and then he was appointed shortly thereafter to the state Supreme Court. And according to Herbert Storing, who I mentioned at the beginning and who is, I think, without question, the foremost scholar on Anti-Federalist thought and their essays, Brutus's essays are amongst the most important in the entire Anti-Federalist canon because of his powerful arguments in four principal points. Brutus argued that little r republican government, by that I mean simply government by the people, for the people, of the people, what we think of when we think of republican government, can really only exist, Brutus argued, in small states, that is, small communities where the communities share a lot of various things in common. And he worried that the plan of the Constitutional Convention was to turn the United States into a single consolidated super megastate. That would be vast in its size and scope, and that would be difficult to govern according to those little r Republican principles. The second thing that he emphasized is he vehemently disagreed with the scope of Article 1, Section 8, that is, the powers that are given to Congress. In particular, he focused on the taxing power and the necessary and proper clause. Third, he worried about the scope of the judicial power in Article 3. And fourth, he worried that as important as the Constitution was for all of the things that it said and he disagreed with, he was just as upset about the things it didn't say, and that is includes in particular the lack of a Bill of Rights. This is something that has come up many, many times in Anti-Federalist essays. Brutus was by far not he wasn't even the first to actually raise it. Sentinel was the first Anti-Federalist to raise it as a concern, but he also wasn't the last to raise it as a concern. In particular, because people of the day in the late 18th century expected to see their rights written down on paper. And so when they didn't see their rights written down on paper, it was a source of concern, as Brutus articulated. So Brutus, as I say, one of the foremost important ones, and Professor Baker and I will talk about him and his responses both to Madison and from Madison and Hamilton as the evening goes on. So next, let's talk about Cato. Many believe that Cato was written, that Cato's papers, were written by George Clinton, who was the governor of New York, later the fourth vice president of the United States. And Cato had a series, a wide-ranging series of essays published under that pseudonym in, that have a lot of commonalities and overlapping with Brutus and some of the others. But one thing that I think that, that Cato contributes that is one particular and uncommon point of emphasis is his concern about Article II of the Constitution and the executive power vested by it. And Cato fretted in many different ways. He thought that Article II would create an American aristocracy. He worried that Article II could create an overly strong executive of such durable and executive power. They would be reminiscent of the sorts of powers that the King of England had and that had prompted the American Revolution. So next, let's talk a little bit about Cincinnatus and who he was and what he thought. Cincinnatus, many think that his essays were written by this man, who's Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. At the time, he was the president of the Continental Congress. And Cincinnatus addressed his essays, I believe all of them, if not all of them, certainly the first several, to the great and noted Federalist James Wilson, later a justice on the Supreme Court. And each one of the essays started to James Wilson, Esquire, because Wilson had given this very impassioned speech in support of the Constitution, and Cincinnatus's goal in responding was to sort of dissect each of Wilson's arguments. Now, Herbert Storing was not particularly impressed with Cincinnatus and his contribution to the Anti-Federalist canon, because in Storing's words, Cincinnatus's essays were full of rhetorical and vulgar excesses that were somewhat common of the day. So, for example, Cincinnatus starts his third essay by saying to Mr. Wilson, quote, "Your speech has varnished an iron trap baited with some illustrious names to catch the liberties of the people." So perhaps you don't like the rhetoric, and perhaps that passes for vulgarity of the day, but you certainly understand, rhetoric or not, the substance of the point, because his principal substantive criticism was that the Constitution would tend toward aristocracy. That's another idea that I hope we can unpack a little bit tonight, is what was the concern about aristocracy? What was behind it? What have we seen today that harkens back to the concerns that the Anti-Federalists raised? But Cincinnatus focused in particular his attention on the Senate and the length of amount of time that senators would serve, the detachment of the people, which was, of course, one of the principal goals and tasks of the creation of the Senate as a body. And indeed, his name, Cincinnatus, itself hearkened to a notion of aristocracy. It is reminiscent of the Society of the Cincinnati, our nation's first veterans organization. It was founded in 1783 in New York, membership in which was originally limited to veterans of the Revolutionary War. And it was a veritable who's who of the American aristocracy, if you could count it as such, at the time. Its first meeting was chaired by Professor Baker's hero, Alexander Hamilton, in which they elected George Washington to be their first president. They were headquartered in Philadelphia, so that during the Constitutional Convention, like while everyone was assembled in the convention hall in Philadelphia, later President Washington, George Washington, could cross over and have lunch with the Society of the Cincinnati. And 23 of the 55 men who signed the Constitution were also members of the Society of the Cincinnati. And that might all sound super cool, and in fact, it is historically quite interesting. But to the Anti-Federalists, it was a terrifying concept because it looked like aristocracy. The membership was obviously limited to elites at the beginning. As I mentioned, it started with folks who were veterans of the Revolutionary War. But from there, it descended hereditarily, much like an aristocracy would. It had tons and tons of power. And this was something that was particularly plaguing to the Anti-Federalist mind. Their meetings, like the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, were all done in secret. So to the common man or the common woman, the secrecy, the power, the hereditary nature of the descent of power was all quite scary. So that was one of the themes of the Cincinnatus writings, both in the substance of the papers that he wrote and in the name that he chose as a pseudonym. Next, let's talk a little bit about Federal Farmer. He's interesting for lots of reasons. One is they're not all of the anti-federalist essays had pseudonyms. The Federal Farmer one obviously is one of them. And for the longest time, we thought Federal Farmer was this man. This is Richard Henry Lee, also of Virginia. So this is the same one who we thought is writing the Cincinnatus essays, right? So we thought Federal Farmer was written by both, I'm sorry, that Richard Henry Lee was writing both sets of essays, just using different pseudonyms. Herbert Storing is super critical of this, thinks it probably wasn't Richard Henry Lee, but he leaves us with a big fat question mark, doesn't really have any idea about who it might have been. A lot of modern historians think that they might have been written by Melancthon Smith, who was a lawyer from New York and served in the Confederation Congress from 1785 to 1788, and also participated in New York's ratification debate. But we don't really know. And one of the things I like about Federal Farmer is that it highlights how little we know about anti-federalists, not just who they are, but also where they came from, what was motivating the thoughts behind the words that they wrote on paper. But if we think about it as being someone like Melancthon Smith, in many ways, the Federal Farmer essays and the views of Mr. Smith are the closest things that the anti-federalists had to a true counterweight to the Federalist Papers. So one of the things that defenders of the Federalists often say is they say, oh, well, the Federalist, you know, it's this cohesive book. It's 85 essays. It's, you know, it reads like, you know, like a seamless discussion from beginning to end, whereas the anti-Federalists were a bunch of, in the words of one scholar, uneducated, debt-ridden farmers who were just taking pot shots with no particularly coherent theory. And they were just saying, no, 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 no. And as Justice Scalia liked to say back in the day, it takes a theory to beat a theory. Well, Federal Farmer actually had a theory. He was one of the anti-federalists who actually had a coherent and systematic response to the anti-federalists. He wrote his essays in two pamphlets, which were consecutively numbered, much like the Federalist was. The first one, Essays 1-5, was published in October of 1787. So if you remember, the Constitution is signed in mid-September of 1787. And this goes to highlight just how quick the anti-Federalists were. You know, they basically got the Constitution, which had been negotiated in secret and they didn't know anything about. They get it in within a month. Federal Farmer had published his first pamphlet of five essays on the topic. And the second one, Essays 6-18, was published in December of 1787, which is lightning speed. It's basically 2 months later and all. So within 2 months, the whole 18 essays are done, and a couple in January of 1788. And I should also say that Hamilton in Federalist 68 credits Federal Farmer as his most worthy adversary in the dispute over the Constitution. One of the things that makes Federal Farmer so unique is that he doesn't actually say that the Constitution as a whole is terrible. You know, we were just talking about Cincinnatus, who has some of these, as Herbert Storing says, rhetorical flourishes and vulgarities. Well, Federal Farmer's essays are much more nuanced. In fact, they're come across as sort of a moderate criticism. They appear to recognize the need of the Constitution. They appear to recognize some of the deficiencies in the Articles of Confederation. The principal Federal Farmer response is to say, we need some amendments to this document before we ratify it, right? We're not content to simply take it and then roll the dice on whether and to what extent we can get amendments later. We want some amendments before ratification. This argument in some ways is successful because obviously they get the amendments later. In other ways, it was unsuccessful. The state of Massachusetts or Commonwealth of Massachusetts eventually decided to ratify first and then send in proposed amendments later. In February of 1788. But again, Federal Farmer, because of this sort of moderate middle position of saying the Constitution is great, but we need these amendments, in some ways actually reflects the history of the Constitution itself, right? The people who didn't want it at all lost, the people who wanted it without amendments lost, and we ended up with a Constitution as amended. And then the last one that I'll just put on the table before turning it over to Professor Baker is in many ways my very favorite of the anti-federalists, and that is A Columbian Patriot. For a long time, we thought the essays, the author behind this essay was Elbridge Gerry, the fifth vice president of the United States. But then in the 1930s, historians uncovered a letter from Gary to this woman, Mercy Otis Warren, thanking her for the essay. And under the Columbian Patriot pseudonym, Warren wrote the Observations on the New Constitution and the Federal and State Conventions, which was also an influential pamphlet printed in Boston, circulated in Philadelphia, New York, North Carolina, and was also a wide-ranging criticism of the Constitution. There are myriad different ways that we could do an entire webinar just on a Columbian Patriot and her criticisms of the Constitution. But one of the most noteworthy ones was that she and others like her proposed and lost an effort to get the Constitution to include term limits for members of Congress. And her essays under her name were cited by the United States Supreme Court in the Thornton case. The hardly Warren's only literary contribution. She had several other influential writings that fomented patriotic fervor before the Revolution. But in my view, all of these men, and importantly, Professor Baker, women, should be considered as our founders. With that, I'll turn it over to you.
Excellent job, but you know, you're going to have to do some punching if you're going to go from underdog to winning this thing. But you know, I'm sure that those watching out there probably think you are the underdog. Why? Well, I'm defending the Federalist. This is sponsored by the Federalist Society, and we've got all these members of the Federalist Society watching. So, do I have an advantage? Not so. Why not? Not many in the audience may know that when the Federalist Society was being formed, there were those who thought it should be called the Anti-Federalist Society. Why? Because most traditional conservatives actually are a lot closer to the Anti-Federalists than they are to the Federalists. I learned this when I was in college at the University of Dallas, where they required reading the Federalist. And I realized after a while, I had been raised as an anti-federalist. Why? Well, first of all, I thought the most important part of the Constitution, like many Americans, maybe most Americans, is the Bill of Rights. And without reading it, I would say that the 10th Amendment left all powers to the state that were not expressly given to the federal government. Of course, that language is really from the Articles of Confederation. It's not in the 10th Amendment. It's deliberately not in the 10th Amendment. And that is the difference between a confederation as we know it now and this new thing that the Federalists developed. But to me, the most important thing, especially now, is for Americans, certainly lawyers and law students, to learn more about the Federalist Papers. And that's why I'm asking that my first slide be put up. And by the way, one difference between us, Judge, I only have a few slides. So, Aaron, you got my slide up there? I know you all recognize him. And this is from 2011, where he and Justice Breyer appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And in the 7 minutes that the justice speaks, it is a very impassioned plea about the need to read the Federalist Papers and the fact that he's so distressed that when he goes around and talks to lawyers and law students and others, he'll say, how many have read the Federalist? And some will put their hands up and he says, no, I don't mean just the big ones. I mean, have you read it cover to cover? And then the hands go down. As he said, only 5% of the people that he talks to have ever read the whole thing cover to cover. But there are places where the Federalist is actually read cover to cover. Where? China. Now, it's not just that I'm teaching the Federalist to them. The book I'm using by Professors Randy Barnett and Josh Blackman have quite a number of the papers, many more than any of the other books I know about, and I add to that. But on top of that, I have a research assistant now. He just got his JD at GW Law School. He's from China. And the reason I have him in large part is because in his Chinese law school, he was required to read The Federalist cover to cover, as well as Democracy in America. And I can't say that that's done everywhere in China, but I can say that in the best law schools in Beijing, the law professors give all of the students a reading list of the Western canon from Plato and Aristotle forward, including the Federalist and Democracy in America. They want to understand America. Why don't our young lawyers and law students want to do that? Well, a large part is it happens to be where they go to law school. Their professors don't want to cover it. Peter Berkowitz explained all this, and it's tied up with the whole progressive agenda. Really, the cancel culture started a long time ago with the progressives, and in particular, Woodrow Wilson, because he said that no decent people would have a constitution like ours. He said in the 18th century, it was, you know, they actually believed in an ordered universe. But we know better now, he says, because we know about social Darwinism and everything is evolving. Well, that really is the root, the start of the notion of the evolving constitution. And if the constitution is evolving, you're deconstructing the text of the constitution. It's, quote, only a starting point. That is what we've had for over 125 years. One of the first things the progressives did was to pull teaching of the Constitution out of grade schools and high schools. There used to be constitutional catechisms, originally written by Justice Story, where he simply reduced the amount of coverage in those catechisms from what was his book, The Commentaries on the Constitution, that educated lawyers. And Story, in that, said that what he did was to combine the text of the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, and the decisions of the Marshall Court. But that ended. That ended. And what do we have? Social studies. And that is anything that the latest fad coming out of the elite schools suggests that social studies teachers ought to be covering. In any event, what I want to do in my time here is to hit 3 points. One, which coincides with the judge, is about what they had in common and the ability to engage in civilized debate. Indeed, for a republic, you have to have civilized public debate. That's the ground. Without that, and of course, we don't get it today with cable television, I understand, but that's very critical. Where they really disagreed, and Judge touched on this, is on the notion of what a republic should be. Judge Olem mentioned that the anti-federalists were inclined towards the small republic. I'll talk about that in a minute when we get there. And on separation of powers and federalism, they agreed in principle, but they didn't agree on how it should be implemented. So what I want to talk about, first of all, is the civilized debate. Besides the fact that they were using Roman names, what contributed to the civility was that they used pseudonyms. And the purpose of a pseudonym is not to hide necessarily, but it is to prevent your opponent from using ad hominem arguments against you. It forces people to actually answer the arguments that are made. We don't see much of that today. People attack your motives. They don't attack or respond to your arguments often enough. The agreements were grounded a lot in their understanding of human nature and society. We had different streams of philosophy that come not only from the ancient world, the medieval world, but the Enlightenment. And you had people, especially John Adams, who were both very devout Christians and yet also men of the Enlightenment. You had others that were nominal Christians, maybe, or universalists or whatever, but they really didn't believe, but they understood the same, that there was an ordered universe. They agreed on certain principles. Only with that agreement could they actually have a decent debate. You can't disagree if you don't agree on something. The problem we see in this country right now is there's not enough agreement on much of anything to be able to have a civilized debate. So what does this all mean about the Federalists? Well, sometimes I debate people on the right and on the left, and their response is, well, the Federalists, it, you know, it was just propaganda to get the Constitution ratified. Well, first of all, people don't understand the role of rhetoric at the founding and its relationship to public argument. So I want you to put up, Aaron, if you would, the next slide. So you all know the importance of Jefferson at the University of Virginia, and most Americans know that Jefferson was no lover of Alexander Hamilton. In fact, when I went to Monticello, went into the foyer there, there is an oversized bust of Thomas Jefferson. Well, you know, I figured that's fine. But I was stunned to look across and see a regular sized bust of Alexander Hamilton. And I asked the guy, or docent, whatever they're called, what is he doing here? And the response was, well, Jefferson wanted to continue looking down on Hamilton, even in death. Now, part of that had to do with the height of Jefferson, 6'2", and Hamilton's 5'7". But really, he meant more than that. He was talking about Hamilton's understanding of the Republic. Hamilton and Jefferson had completely different, conflicting understandings of a Republic, what it should be. So, in trying to answer those who say that the Federalist Papers are simply propaganda, you probably can't see it on this screen, but I'll pull up the next one, which takes the language from it that I want to focus on. So Jefferson is saying what law students must be taught. And he identifies three things they have to read. The first is the Federalist. The second is the Virginia Resolutions on the Alien and Sedition Acts. And of course, the third is the Declaration of Independence. And he says here, the reason for the first is that it is an authority to which appeal is habitually made by all and rarely declined or denied by any, as evidence of the general opinion of those who made and of those who accepted the Constitution of the United States on questions as to its genuine meaning. In other words, the Federalist Papers is not merely something that you show your erudition by dropping it in a brief or an opinion by a court. It is serious business and it takes serious study. I want to add here that this document is from 1825, the year of the first class at University of Virginia, although I understand the first law class was not until the next year. And it is aimed at the law school, and that in the branch of the school of law, which is to treat on the subject of government, these shall be used as the text and the documents of the school, and no principles inculcated which do not harmonize with them. You can't get a better endorsement of Hamilton's project, because it was Hamilton's project, to write the Federalist Papers than from his archenemy, Jefferson. And this statement is made not only after Marbury, it's made after McCulloch. And McCulloch is straight out of Federalist 23. And as Justice Scalia used to say, Marbury is plagiarized from Federalist 78. The problem with only reading Federalist 78, which some law professors only offer, is that it seems to support the notion of judicial supremacy. But when you read the whole of the Federalist Papers and you understand what's at stake about separation of powers and how critical it is, then you realize that it's not judicial supremacy at all. I know Federalists often cite the language about judges shall have no will or power, but what they leave off is what follows. And courts must depend on the executive for the enforcement of their orders. Marshall and Jefferson completely understood this in Marbury versus Madison. Marshall knew that Jefferson, who didn't let Madison go to the argument, wasn't about to enforce any judgment from that court. Marshall, however, was a good bit more clever than Jefferson, but we'll talk more about that as we go along. Two, I want to talk about disagreement about republics. Judge Oldham has already mentioned that the big deal was about small republics versus the large commercial republic. Why is this important? Because the Anti-Federalists believed that to be a republic, you had to really know everybody. You had to know everybody, and you had to know your representatives, and they had to know you, and you could only do that in a small area. And they took this from a Frenchman, Montesquieu, and it will shock many Americans that the one author cited repeatedly in the Federalist is not John Locke. It is Montesquieu. Can we believe that our notions, both on both sides of the founders, are from a Frenchman? Can you believe that? Now, the other person they cite at the end is Hume. In other words, neither Montesquieu nor Hume were what we call complete rationalists. They were much more grounded in other things like tradition and habits and sentiments. In any event, what the Anti-Federalists thought was that you had to have virtue, because if the people weren't virtuous, then you'd have to have a lot of force in government. And most political theorists understand this. And they realized that you could only do that in a small community. Well, I've never lived on a farm, but I've asked people all over the world who are from small towns, I ask them what it's like in a small town. And there are a lot of good things. Neighbors help neighbors. Somebody gets in trouble, they'll help them. The downside, they almost always say, is everybody knows your business. And that, more than anything, explains a lot of what goes on, has gone on in the United States regarding discrimination, both on race, but also on the basis of religion, basis of ethnicity, which is, of course, the subject of Federalist 10, which we won't get into right now. But the Federalists, on the other hand, they also cited, for every argument the Anti-Federalists made based on Montesquieu, the Federalists came back and turned it on their head. So the argument in Federalist 9 and 10 is that, no, Montesquieu said the strongest government is a confederal republic, where you assemble various smaller republics together, and it has the strength of a monarchy on the outside and the liberty of a republic on the inside. That's why the notion that the people are sovereign is real. I used to think it was just kind of a theory, but no, it is real. They give certain power to the federal government, and they give certain power to their own state constitutions, so that no one body is completely sovereign, even only externally and vis-a-vis other nations. And that was the way to protect liberty, as far as the Federalists were concerned, and also the Anti-Federalists. The difference is, the Federalists thought that the experience of the Articles of Confederation had proven that a confederation simply doesn't work. It works for certain purposes, but there's a difference between a treaty organization and a government. And that's Hamilton's whole point in Federalist 15. And people in the European Union have never figured this out. They don't want to listen to the Federalists. Eastern Europeans do, but not Western Europeans. They decided that they were going to be great founders, but they were going to do it differently. Well, in the European Union, at least in theory, as England is finding, you can separate. They're making it as difficult as possible. But unlike our country, in which the South thought they could separate because they thought it was a confederation, we have an insurrection clause in the Constitution that says, no, you can't go. We have a compacts clause that says, no, you can't make compacts among states without Congress's permission. No, states can't make compacts with other nations. So they understood confederations, and those who drafted the Constitution certainly were not going to continue with a confederation. That's where they thought the difficulty was. And today we've got a different problem we can talk about later. That's the administrative state. That is not Republican at all. It takes self-government away from both founding views and sticks it in so-called experts in bureaucracy, but more about that later. In terms of what they agreed on and how they differ, separation of powers and federalism are where they differ. And what happens in the Federalist is that the it's Madison mostly, Publius, but yes, it's Madison is in 47 and 48. What he does is to take Montesquieu's notion and argue to the anti-federalists, look, Montesquieu didn't have a complete separation in mind. And he argues that. And then he says, based on our experience, we know that doesn't work because the reality in the states was that legislatures were all powerful. The reality is that our three branches are equal only artificially. That is, as Madison says, the legislative branch is inherently the most powerful in any popular government. So the plan was to weaken the legislature by cutting it in half and making it difficult for the two houses to get along together, and then strengthening the other two, the president by the veto, and also the fact that he's only one, and the court with the power that we today call judicial review, but it wasn't called that back then. So there's more I have to say. Oh, well, federalism, need to talk about that. In Federalist 39, Madison says, in truth, this is neither a federal republic nor a national government. It is instead a compound republic. Parts of it are federal and parts of it are national. And that, I think, is the strength. The weakness has been, I think, the 17th Amendment, which gutted a major federal element, and that was the states were members of the Senate where they could control the House. Yeah, the senators still think they can control the House, but they are not on the chain that they used to be from state legislators. Senators don't pay that much attention to what state legislatures do these days or what they care about, but they would pay attention if they were still elected by them. But stupidly, the states gave away the basic protection of federalism. I've got more to say, but I'll stop here because I don't want to go too long. And Judge, you got to come back and hit me.
Yeah, well, I'm going to pick up on one thing you said, and I'm curious about what the Federalist response would be. So you mentioned the administrative state. And right. One of the things that's interesting about the way the anti-federalists and the federalists talk is that there's a whole lot of, I think we both talked a little bit about political theory and differences in political theory, but there's also differences in prediction, right? The Federalists and the anti-federalists have a different thought about what's going to happen with this document once right. The people adopt it. So let me give you some things from Cato 4 and 5. And you tell me if you think you see in here, and I'd be curious about the audience's reaction. The seeds of the debate over the administrative state. And I'm curious what the response would be from the Federalists. So this is Cato's fear, right? He frets that the scope of Article 2 is so vast, that is the executive power vested in the president is so vast, it would inevitably generate, quote, a dangerous council collected from the great officers of state and comprised of favorites and flatterers, right? Sounds like some sort of government agency of some sort. He went on to worry that the 10-mile square, that's the obviously the District of Columbia, which is to become the seat of government, will of course be the place of residence for the presidents and the great president and great officers of state, and that this power-dense capital would turn into the court of the president, just like England's monarchs had royal courts that acted as executive auxiliaries for enforcing the law. And then the vast array of people who work in the 10-mile square, Cato worries, and serve in these administrative functions will be set apart from the rest of the country, that they will have their own language and manners. Those are his quotes. They will be united in adulation of people of fortune and power. They will form their own type of aristocracy in the sense that they won't leave office, that they will be there in permanence, and that they will be separated from those, quote, meanly born, that is common, normal Americans, and unaccountable to them. They'll have extraordinary powers that derive from the president, but they will exercise them in ways that are not accountable to the people. So what's the response to that?
Well, the response goes back to the administrative state. Remember, Wilson and the progressives wanted to, quote, cancel the Federalist. They did. This is not the Federalists going forward. This is a new entity imported from German thinking. This is not American. This is, and I'm glad in a way, all the bad things about cancel culture, it was at least, if you're going to cancel somebody, cancel Woodrow Wilson, who got canceled at Princeton from the School of International Affairs. No, this was a direct attack on the Constitution. They laid it out, and academics bought into it. And basically, for over 100 years, most academics, at least in elite schools, don't like the Constitution. They did everything they could to undermine it. You can't attribute that to the Federalist when, in fact, the Federalist system is being attacked by the progressives. As to the city, you're right. But, you know, until Lyndon Johnson came in, Washington was considered a backwater. In a lot of countries, the capital, like for years in Brazil, Brasilia was a backwater, okay? I mean, my law partner at one point, he had been there for decades, beginning before the 50s. And he said, you know, it was a small town. Once the Great Society started and Washington began to regulate everything and there was lots of money, follow the money and the power. That's what changed in Washington. And yes, it is like what the anti-federalists, but don't blame the Federalists. Blame the progressives who tried to and have in part succeeded in overthrowing the Federalist design.
So what do you make of what, how about here's another one. What about the idea that the things that Brutus, for example, focuses on when he's criticizing Article 1 of the proposed Constitution, is he focuses on the taxing power, right? Because he says the notion that this won't expand is, in his words, in his crazy, and the necessary and proper clause, right? And most of his argument is about, at least with respect to Article 1, is that these two things combined with the commerce power will give the new national government these broad powers that in 1789 they couldn't have predicted. He says we won't understand what the future will hold, but we can see in these the seeds of growth, which seems to be part of a conservative argument today.
Well, in large part, they understood they couldn't see. And that's why when people say the text of the Constitution, not you, but others, that it's outdated. Apart from the Bill of Rights, there's nothing hardly in the basic Constitution that gets outdated. If you look at the powers in Article 1, if the United States lasts for 1,000 more years, we're still going to need military. We're going to still need coin or money. We're still going to have bankruptcy. We're still going to have naturalization issues. Those are very general powers that any country needs. So that part is not evolving. What you mentioned was the necessary and proper clause. And what was the other one you said?
So Brutus's word, the necessary and proper clause, the taxing power.
Okay. Taxing power is wonderful. Who is responsible for the income tax? The middle class. The middle class wanted free trade because they didn't want to pay the tariff duties. And they didn't think they would ever going to be hit with it. There was somebody who proposed that the income tax be limited to 10%. And they say, oh, that's ridiculous. It'll never hit 10%. It was the corporations back then that wanted the protectionism. We flipped. And once the corporations flipped, they began over time to understand that they could make more money doing international trade. Well, as Donald Trump has pointed out and proven, this whole notion of extended free trade has cost a lot of middle class jobs. There is a relationship. And people always have the notion that Russell Long used to say, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree. Taxes are always an issue. But in a federal system, you have competition among the states, at least as the state taxes. And that's why the governor of Texas can go to California and Illinois, as Rick Perry did, and invite all those corporations to leave there, come down there. people in our system are free to vote with their feet. And a lot of people right now are leaving New York for various reasons, but even before the riots, they were leaving for tax reasons. As to the necessary and proper clause, I was in a Liberty Fund seminar one time with various peoples, and one of them was a philosopher, at least one, maybe more than one. And he read McCullough for the first time, and he said, "This sounds like Aristotle." And what he meant was that there was a discussion of means and ends. That's true throughout Hamilton's discussions, in particular Federalist 23. On the other hand, if you don't reason in that way, if you go to, quote, consequentialist reasoning, which is typical of law schools these days, why? When you go to, quote, policymaking, which is a legislative function, it is, as Aristotle says, you're supposed to focus on the consequences. Legislatures are supposed to look forward in terms of what would be expedient. Judges are supposed to look backward to see what the law is now. And legislatures aren't supposed to do things that are ex post facto or retroactive. Still haven't laid a glove on me.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, these are the anti-federalist arguments. The fact that the Federalists had responses to them is part of, I think, the fun of all of this. What about the what I think is a really interesting point, and I think you brought up as well, the debate about Article 3 and the scope of the federal judicial power. So you, I think you mentioned, I can't remember if you said 76 or 78, but you mentioned, yeah, one of the Hamiltonian essays on Article 3.
You mean you aren't fully familiar with 78?
Oh, no, sorry. I know them both, but I wasn't sure which one you had referenced. Sorry. But one of the criticisms of the anti-federalists launched, and there were a series of them, but I'll try to lay a couple of them out and we'll see sort of how you think the federalists best respond to it. One of the anti-federalist criticisms is they say it'll be the least dangerous branch. But what we worry about with life, tenure, and salary protection, the anti-federalists would say, is that it insulates judges, but it also makes judges part of the federal government. And so it'll be part of the federal judges will become part of the federal, the sort of expansion of federal power, so the anti-federalists worry, right? That is that Congress would pass statutes that would aggrandize federal power, that federal judges would interpret those federal statutes to aggrandize federal power, and then it would all be done, they were concerned, to the derogation of the states. And that because, and as you know, as you also know, the anti-federalists were fond of saying that when you make federal judges the final word on these sorts of things, as you point out, Marbury and the rest of it, that creates a certain degree of, I'm not sure if the anti-federalists ever said supremacy, but they did sort of have the idea that later came up. I believe was it Justice Jackson who said that the Supreme Court is not final because they're infallible. They're infallible insofar as they're final.
But I don't think it was Jackson. I forget whether it was Taft or Hughes.
Yeah. Anyway, but so they clearly were concerned about this very notion that we still seem to talk about today.
Right. No, of course. But I ask you this. Before the 17th Amendment, can you imagine a senator like we've seen over the last 40 years beating a potential Supreme Court nominee over the head to know whether they are going to expand rights? Because who is at the receiving end of expanding rights? The states. Basically, they're saying, are you going to do to the states what we want you to do? That's what it comes down to. If some of the outrageous decisions of the Supreme Court had been announced during a period where senators could be yanked by state senators, by state legislatures, you would have had a very different judiciary.
Well, one of my my colleagues, Leslie Southwick, just recently published a law review article on judicial selection. And one of the points he makes in the article is that judicial selection has been a contentious idea and concept for a long time. he argues. And he also reminds us, of course, as you know, that Marbury itself came over a political fight about, but that is between the political branches and the courts.
But remember that in Marbury, the real issue was not judicial review, what we call judicial review. I mean, Chisholm was a case of judicial review. The real issue was separation of powers, because what enraged Jefferson was the claim by Marshall that he could mandamus his Secretary of State. That's what enraged him. It was a different notion of separation of powers, where under the Jeffersonian view and that view of the Anti-Federalist, they should be like stovepipes that didn't interact. And in Federalist 78, which is virtually plagiarized in Marbury, it lays down the rule that there is a special role of the court interpreting the law. But this goes along with something else. And that is, until Oliver Wendell Holmes, the notion that a court opinion was just a court opinion. It was their opinion. In Swift versus Tyson, which was overruled, we know, by Erie, Story says, you wouldn't say that a judicial opinion is the law. And that's exactly what Cardozo said in Erie, disagreeing with it and giving the victory to Holmes, who had taken that position. In other words, the judicial role was understood differently over time. And where did that come? It came largely from Harvard Law School. Because in the 1890s, Llewellyn put in a new idea on how to teach law. And it wasn't just about cases. It was the notion, a social Darwinian notion, that what law was all about was picking and choosing the better precedents, moving the law along because it was evolving. And of course, the judge role in this became much more important than it had been. And people, and you know, look, you know that judges tend to give back in their opinions what they learned in law school. Fortunately, you had a good course and more in the Anti-Federalist.
Well, one of my professors, John Manning, from whom I learned a lot, but he's one of the people that you referenced earlier who suggested that we shouldn't be reading the Federalist Papers because they were anonymous propaganda, and I understand the argument that he made, but I certainly agree with you also that these are incredibly important pieces of information for understanding the original public meaning of the terms and the concepts that are debated in the Constitution. Why don't we turn it over to questions? I want to make sure that we have enough time to hear from the audience, and so maybe Rachel can help us take some of those.
Great. Thank you both. And before we open it up to questions, we have a poll that we're going to open up to the audience. So audience, please look out for the poll and pick your winner, Federalist or Anti-Federalist. And while that poll is going on, we will go to questions. All right, so we have a raised hand from Michael Patton.
Did you say Michael Pack?
Michael Patton. Oh, okay. And Michael, you're unmuted, so go ahead.
All right, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So I have a question for Judge Oldham. How would you respond to someone who claims that we shouldn't consider the Anti-Federalist Papers because they comment on expansive ways that the Constitution could be interpreted in a manner consistent with its original public meaning? For example, Brutus I referenced how Article I, Section 8 could be read incredibly broadly, even though it was Article I, Section 8 was intended to be a narrow limit on Congress's power. Don't we want to shy away from allowing provisions of the Constitution to be interpreted broadly based on the fears of the Anti-Federalists?
Well, thank you. It's a very insightful question. My view about all of these things is that when you're trying to think about original public meaning and the understanding of a particular, whether it's a word or a phrase or a concept, it's important to think about the way that people would have understood these concepts at the time. And so one of the great things about the Anti-Federalist Papers, when read in conjunction with the Federalist, is that they have an ability to frame the concepts and say, this is what we understand these terms to mean, whatever it is, the judicial power, Article 1, Section 8, as you point out, Article 2 and the vesting clause, what the executive power is. All of these concepts are things that give rise to a range of meanings. And I think that range of meanings is elucidated by the way people were talking about the concepts at the time. Which way it points and what the vectors are in terms of those meaning, I think is, you know, that's interesting and obviously context specific. But I think in terms of doing the originalist project, that is to think about how concepts would mean, what concepts would mean in their original public meaning. I think the greater the breadth of the sources that you're considering and the greater the sense of the debate that you're trying to account for, the more accurate your understanding of that meaning will be.
Great. Let's go to another question. We have a question from Caleb Stevens.
Aaron, can you take the slide down now and pick your winner?
Hi. So I was wondering, I've heard a few arguments on the 17th Amendment before, arguing that it potentially wasn't even constitutionally ratified, given that at least one or two of the states never actually ratified it in their states, given the clause specifying that the states aren't allowed to, or that amendments have to be unanimous if they take away representation in the Senate. So I was wondering about your thoughts on that from either of you.
Judge, you may not be able to say anything because at some point it might come before you. I've long considered this, and I think that those states that didn't do it, that they have been wrongly deprived of their representation in the Senate. Yeah, they have two senators, but they're not representing the state. That was the compromise to keep an element of the Confederation in the new Constitution. And at least until there is a change in the majority of the Supreme Court, it would not be a good time to bring that kind of litigation, but that may soon change.
Let's go to a question from Jeffrey Ventrella.
Sorry. Thank you both for your comments and scholarship. The question I have, we know that the Federalist Party went in kind of demise really after Jefferson was elected president and so forth, and yet Chief Justice Marshall kept the Federalist light alive in a lot of his jurisprudence. The question I have, is there a similar parallel by a jurist or a group of jurists that kept alive the anti-Federalist vision?
Tawney.
Oh. I think certainly the jurist of the present time who talks the most about the anti-federalists is certainly has to be Justice Thomas. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. He is an anti-federalist.
Well, he certainly cites the papers with some regularity. I don't remember if it was last term or two terms ago that the case overturning Nevada versus Hall has several pages of extended exegesis of the debate between the anti-federalists and the Federalists. And I think in some ways that elucidates the question, the very first question that we got in the Q&A, which is sort of how to think about these concepts and how to think about the various papers and the way that they have meaning elucidate meaning of the Constitution.
But well, I'd like to add to that. It seems to me we need more Jeffersonians in Congress and Federalists in the judiciary, because Congress, while it's interpretation of the Constitution, will be subject to what the Supreme Court says, yes. On the other hand, the whole business about necessary and proper and why the court is deferring to Congress is they're the ones to make that judgment. There's no reason why senators and representatives cannot get up and say, this is unconstitutional because it's not necessary and proper for the following reasons. But they don't do that. We know after the Obamacare, they don't even read the bills. Indeed, they can't read the bills. They're too long, there are too many of them. So we don't really have self-government. We have members of Congress who often don't vote on things. The Senate will often do things by unanimous consent. They're not deliberating the way they're supposed to be. They're kicking it over to the judiciary. For all their criticism of the judiciary, the Congress loves to draft vague statutes so they can tell all their constituents on both sides of an issue that I voted for you. I voted for you. Oh, the court did it badly. They didn't do what I wanted them to do. Well, then you didn't draft it properly. You didn't deliberate properly. You didn't do your job. That's the problem. Jeff, thanks for your question.
Let's go to a question from Adam Griffin.
Thank you both for this excellent debate. My question is, what was the anti-federalist best argument at the time? And then what is the anti-federalist most enduring argument today? And then for the Federalists, what was the Federalist best argument at the time? And what is the Federalist most enduring argument for the Constitution today? Thank you.
Professor Baker, do you want to go first or should I?
It's up to you.
I'm happy to go first. I think it's very difficult to argue with respect to both questions. I would think that the anti-federalist's best argument has to be the Bill of Rights. I mean, it's hard to quibble with it. There was a ton of writing at the time in across various anti-federalist essays about the need for a Bill of Rights. And it wasn't sort of the way we talk about it today. You know, Professor Baker and I have talked about Justice Scalia's view about how the Bill of Rights is just, these are parchment barriers, right? That they're just things that are written down on paper, and the real provisions of the Constitution that protect liberty are the structural provisions. And I certainly understand Justice Scalia's view about that. And far be it for me to suggest he was wrong. The anti-federalists' concern is that, you know, there was a long and storied history of people writing down their rights against, that they reserve against the government, and went back to Magna Carta and Runnymede and King John, the Petition of Right, the first English Bill of Rights of 1689. And then by the time we got to America, many of the states had bills of rights at the time. One of my favorite examples is the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, where Sentinel, who was the very first anti-federalist essay, he was the very first one to raise an argument. And his first argument was, where's the Bill of Rights? I don't see my Bill of Rights. I'm expecting to see it because that's what we put in these sorts of documents, and we don't see it. And that was a cause of alarm, just simply because there was no attempt to write it down. And it's I certainly understand why the founders in Philadelphia had made the decision that they did, but it raised a concern in the anti-federalist mind that the reason for not writing them down is a concern of not respecting those rights. And I think the anti-federalists largely prevailed on that. Obviously, they got the Bill of Rights almost immediately. And so I think that would be, I mean, it's obviously something we still revere today. So I think that would probably be the answer on the AF side.
Well, some of the people who were arguing for Bill of Rights really were concerned about states' rights. That is, many of the rights, not the First Amendment so much, but the others are common law rights. And even without a Bill of Rights, they would have been generally respected. And what some like Mason wanted was the protection that they couldn't be removed. And I understand that. And a Bill of Rights is certainly extremely critical in the age of the administrative state. So on the one hand, Justice Scalia would say, if you think the Bill of Rights is what protects our liberty, quote, you're crazy. On the other hand, we're not living in the same world. We're not living in a republic. We're living in an administrative state. We've seen the power that can be exercised by federal prosecutors. There's been a lot of abuse about power. And the fact is, you have, quote, certain rights in federal prosecution, but I don't know what good it does you if you it's going to cost you $4 or $5 million to defend it. And that's a low number. It's not a high number. And how many people can afford to do that? The reason Skilling in the Enron case got to the Supreme Court, he had a $42 million D&O policy that covered his litigation expenses. And when you're paying for white collar defense in DC and New York at $1,000 to $1,200 and even $1,500 an hour, $2 million goes by quickly.
You know, one other thing that we didn't have a chance to talk about that I think is kind of is an interesting idea to in terms of arguments that were made at the time, is, you know, there was a lot of anti-federalist concern about slavery. And I don't know, Professor Baker, you might have something, you might know of something in the Federalist Papers that I'm forgetting, but I can think of several anti-federalist essays that were very critical about the notion of the compromise on the 1808 clause. I know Herbert Storing has said this, that it's not necessarily true that the anti-federalists as a whole were more anti-slavery than the federalists. But Storing says that at least that the anti-federalists were less willing to compromise on the concept, right? That there was that they saw that as a real stain on the Constitution. It was something that they had raised as an objection.
Well, Hamilton and Gouverneur Morris were strong anti-slavery people. And Gouverneur Morris was head of the Committee of Detail. And you don't see a reference to slave as such in the Constitution. And Frederick Douglass defended the Constitution as an anti-slavery document. And he did it as a textualist. And there's a serious question, and it's dealt with in the Prigg case, about whether or not the fugitive slave statute, shortly enacted a couple of years after the first Congress started, whether that's actually constitutional. And there's an interesting argument that Judge Lawyer at the time, Chase, later Chief Justice, makes that unlike the full faith and credit clause, which has an enforcement provision, that the clause that doesn't even mention slavery, but talks about those who are under contract for labor, there's no enforcement there. And it's an very interesting situation. So one can make, and there were very many interesting arguments about it. And much of this came about after Madison's notes became public. And that's where the abolitionists, the radical abolitionists, took the position that the Constitution was a deal with the devil. And that radical argument, with which Frederick Douglass did not agree, has been adopted by the left in this country.
Let's go to a question from Garrett Snedeker.
Okay, can both of you hear me?
Hey, Garrett.
It's a little low, but I can hear you.
Great. Great to be chatting with both of you. Thank you for your presentations and for your back and forth thus far. About 6 months ago, lawyer and opinion editor at Newsweek, Josh Hammer, and I had an extended chat that we recorded for a podcast about judicial supremacy. And one of the subjects we got on was just how do you kind of perform public teaching and try to restore, you know, the proper understanding of the limits of judicial power in a system where individual actors in the Congress, the executive, don't seem to have the kind of institutional ambition that the Federalist presumes. And I guess we were speculating if it's actually going to fall to judges to perform the role of sort of Republican schoolmaster to kind of teach what is possible to restore the proper balance in terms of ascertaining true constitutionality as a conversation between all three branches. How do you think the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists would react to our current just situation right now? Which seems to be hewing much closer to judicial supremacy than anything else. And what would they say about judges having to perform that educative function?
Judge, you can take on the one about the education function by judges.
Well, I think, it's a great question. Thank you, Garrett. And obviously a lot in it. So I think, this is a topic that is certainly discussed at great length in the Federalist and Anti-Federalist essays. This is not like a modern innovation where we're just now discovering this as a concept. And I think, one of the issues that we have to deal with is that, you know, that there are three branches of government. There are supposed to work. They do provide checks and balances for one another. And so the judiciary obviously has a role that is supposed to play in that. I think if you read the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists together, there is a broad agreement that with the principles that Hamilton specifically said, that is that the judiciary has neither force nor will, but merely judgment. And I think reminding people in terms of, you know, the educative function that judges have about what it means to be the least dangerous branch and the modesty of courts in approaching the cases and controversies, I think is an essential task of the judiciary. That's why, you know, I think it's important for a lot of reasons. One is this, the broader general constitutional principle that we're talking about here tonight. But I also think even in a specific case, it can be an important concept because it helps explain why we have some of the doctrines that we have. Why do we have a case or controversy requirement? Why do we have the standing requirements, whether it's injury or traceability? They all stem out of the notion that the judiciary and the judicial branch are limited in their jurisdiction. They're limited in the sorts of cases that they can decide. They're limited in the sort of relief that they can provide. And I think all of that stems from the same debate that the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists were engaged in.
Let's go to a question from Sergio Rojas.
Is my speaker on?
Mm-hmm. We can hear you.
Okay. I think Judge Oldham made the point earlier that one of the concerns of anti-federalists were about the concentration of power in the nation's capital, which ended up being DC, correct? Mm-hmm. But then Professor Baker said that largely came about after Lyndon Johnson's Great Society in the 60s, and that DC before the 60s was seen as a sort of backwater. I would just like to sort of push back on that. I mean, a lot of the sort of like older scandals in American history, you think Teapot Dome, the little greenhouse on K Street, all happened during the 20s, far before the Great Society. And even in the 19th century, we had a lot of scandals in the Grant administration with sort of Washington power players. So I'm not really sure if Professor Baker's point makes sense, and if the anti-federalist sort of premonition of the seat of power having all these people gain sort of like undue influence was actually correct, if that makes sense. My question.
Wherever there's power, there will be some corruption. But the corruption in Washington today is on a scale that nobody could have imagined. I mean, until a few years ago, I wouldn't say that. But the whole thing is rigged. And actually, Hamilton addresses this in one of the early Federalist Papers. He says that if laws are so many that nobody can know what they are, you really don't have the rule of law. And he adds that in those circumstances, the well-connected and the clever will do better than ordinary people. That's exactly what we have because of many things in the way we have structured things. And it has to do with money. It has to do with the amount of money that the federal government has to dispense. And because it doesn't have a direct power over the states in many places, it becomes a bribe situation. If you want your money, this is what you got to do. You got to do it our way. And, you know, when they had a shutdown of government and the media was going crazy, I talked to people in some of the big departments and they said, we're operating a lot more efficiently with 200 people than with several thousand people. You know, Washington could go on a huge diet and we'd all be a lot better off.
And I think we have time for one more question. Let's go to Gary Scott.
Here we go. Good evening, Judge Oldham and Professor Baker. My question is kind of a follow-up on Sergio's because whenever Judge Oldham brought up Federal Farmer 18, and you were very quick to deflect that to Professor Baker, saying that, well, that's not what the Federalists, you know, that's not their fault. But don't you think that, I mean, can an argument be made that it's the very centralization of power that the Federalists advocated that make that situation possible? And then a situation where power is more fragmented among smaller entities, then it would be much harder for progressives to gain the amount of power that they have and to erode those safeguards that the Federalists, you know, put in place, as opposed to, you know, this huge monolithic centralized power we have, where, you know, they really just have to take that over and they have the whole nation.
There's a misconception on the part of many people in this country that when they say limited power, they think the federal government's power should generally be limited, but they should have powers everywhere. No, what it's all about is a limited number of powers. And as Federalist 23 says, as to any power that is given, there is no limit on it. And if you have a New Deal administration, and ever since, that has expanded through an abusive interpretation of the Commerce Clause, abetted by judges, then you have no limits on federal power. But when we get in a war, I don't want any limit on the federal government's ability to defend us, other than moral limits. I don't want a limit on its power.
You know, one thing I think is interesting, I had asked a similar sort of question to my federal courts professors years after I left law school, my beloved Fed courts professor. And I said something to the effect of, you know, what would you think if you could sit down and have a cup of tea or coffee with James Madison, what he would think about this or that or the other provision of the Constitution and what has happened with it in the years hence. And he said, I think he would be shocked that we still have this Constitution and we only had to amend it, he being Madison, and we only had to amend it 27 times. I think one of the things that's most interesting about the Federalist Anti-Federalist debate, and one of the great things about the Federalist Society for putting this together, is how so many of the things that were debated in the 1780s have this enduring relevance to today. I think it's often you can sit down and read one of these debates and listen to the sort of things that the kinds of words they were using, the sorts of things that they were worried about. And it's the same sorts of things that we talk about and are worried about to this very day. So regardless of how much they could have foreseen or not foreseen, I do think that the people of great vision, men and women who were writing these essays have given us a great legacy and a great thing to study and to learn from.
All right, well, I think that's all the time we have for questions. And so let's take a look at the results of the poll.
Hey.
All right, it looks like Team Anti-Federalist is the winner at 57%. So congratulations, Team Anti-Federalist and Judge Oldham. Thank you, Judge Oldham.
That proves my opening point. The Federalist Society is full of anti-federalists.
I credit the boxing gloves.
Well, thank you so much, Judge Oldham and Professor Baker, for your discussion tonight. It was really wonderful. And thank you so much to all of you who joined us this evening. So take care, everyone, and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much, Professor Baker.